I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's nearly impossible to think that black people don't have it better today than 25, 50, or even 100 years ago. But with every advancement on the part of African Americans came a backlash from white America. And it's still happening, according to our first guest. From the Civil War to today, we'll trace the actions and effects of what she calls white rage. Then we'll talk about the Kansas budget with the man whose job it is to monitor it. Director of the budget, Sean Sullivan, will give us his view of the Sunflower State's fiscal dilemma. Later, Brian McTavish brings us his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The anger of African Americans that erupted in Ferguson, Missouri back in 2014 was sparked by the shooting death of Michael Brown at the hands of the police. However, the actual cause goes much deeper and much further back, says our first guest, all the way back to the time of the Civil War, and the source isn't black anger, but white rage. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Dobbs Professor in the African American Studies Department at Emory University. She's the author of several books on African American history, including her latest, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And Professor Anderson, welcome to Up to Date.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Your book has gotten all kinds of national attention of late, including during the confirmation hearings of the Attorney General, new Attorney General Jeff Sessions, no less a source than Illinois Senator Dick Durbin reading excerpts from your book during those hearings. That has to help book sales a little bit. Am I right?
It doesn't hurt at all, I got to tell you.
But what did you make of all that?
What I made of it was that because this book really focuses on the way that policies work, because often when we think of rage, we're thinking, and particularly when we think of white rage, we're thinking of like the Klan and crosses burning. But I'm talking about something that is very cool, that's very methodical, and via policies, the way Congress works, the way that...
Under the radar in some ways.
Under the radar. I mean, because who's going to all of those meetings figuring out what all of those words and statutes mean? But Durbin, in that Sessions confirmation hearing, he started reading from a section dealing with the disparate sentencing between crack and cocaine. So here we have a drug that is basically the same drug, yet you've got 100 times greater sentencing for having, you need to have 100 times more of cocaine to get the same doggone sentence as you have for a rock or crack. And this is where we begin to see this massive incarceration of black people. And I see it coming out of the civil rights movement. Because once you have a felony conviction on you, all of a sudden those rights that were gained via the civil rights movement, such as voting rights, such as the right to housing, the right to employment, education, access to education, all of those get curtailed with that felony conviction.
And that's your premise here, your central idea in this book, that for every major advancement that African Americans have enjoyed, there's been an equal backlash, a result of white rage.
Yes, absolutely. And it has been very destructive as well, and not just destructive to African Americans, but we begin to think about what it means to American society writ large. So, for instance, one of the areas I deal with is education. And so I look at like the Brown decision.
Brown versus Board in Topeka.
Exactly. Which, you know, landmark decision says there is no room for separate but equal in the United States of America. And this is when we are supposed to see this wonderful blossoming in terms of education, in terms of really providing quality education to all our children.
But it didn't happen.
No. The backlash was intense. And again, not just the Klan. Because the Klan gets supported and sanctioned by governors, by state legislators, by the so-called respectable people in society. And here you have a place like in Virginia, for instance. Virginia's response was to, in fact, shut down the public schools. And so you take a place like Prince Edward County, where those schools were shut down for 5 years. Now, what they did was they provided taxpayer-funded vouchers to pay the tuition for white children to go to all white private academies, but provided nothing for black children for 5 years. So from the time the child's in the fifth grade, the time the child's in the 10th grade, nothing. And we begin to think about the kind of impact that that has on a society.
Let's regroup here a little bit and start, as your book does, go with the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment, which we just discussed on this show the other day. This was the constitutional ending of slavery. This was a crippling blow to the South, and I'm wondering why.
Well, a major part why the Emancipation Proclamation was so hard on the South is that the South's economy had been based upon slavery.
Depended on it.
Now, one of the things, too, that we have to be cognizant of is at the time of the Civil War, 80% of the nation's GNP, not just the South, the nation's GNP was dependent upon slavery.
80%.
80%. And so, but for the South, it was much more visible there, because you, in fact, had the enslaved working on those plantations. So it wasn't like you saw the dollars as they moved up into New York, for instance, in terms of the production of the material. Nevertheless, and you had their social structure and their cultural structure based upon slavery. And so this is like ripping all of the moorings of that society out.
I was going to say, fear of losing that labor force gives rise to the black codes adopted by Southern states. What were some of the practices allowed by these black codes, Carol?
Yeah, so the black codes said that an African-American had to sign an annual labor contract and could not leave that employer for a year, regardless of the conditions, regardless of the pay. Now, you begin to think about what that works in a capitalist society. If you can get a better job someplace else, you're going to go. Mm-hmm. But the black codes said no. The black codes also said that African Americans could not work any other job but agriculture unless they had the permission of the judge or a mayor.
Wow.
It also said that blacks couldn't hunt or fish, because you think about it, if you don't want to basically re-enslave yourself to an employer, usually the old plantation owner, you're like, all I got to do is make sure I can feed mine. I can feed my children. I can feed myself.
Right.
But if you've got a prohibition against hunting and fishing, then you can't feed yourself, and it forces you into that labor market.
That's really insidious. You can't hunt or fish.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and that's how these codes work, this language works. So it just looks on the surface like, okay, no hunting and fishing. But what it's really about is you will starve unless you submit.
African Americans convicted of crimes, you write in here, were then swept into the prison system to have their labor fill the coffers of the state. Was there any way out of these alternate forms of slavery?
No. I mean, the only way out was to have the mayor or a judge sign off that the skills that you learned while enslaved, such as being a blacksmith, that you could, in fact, ply that trade. Other than that, you had to go work in the agricultural sector. And if you refused, then you could be charged with vagrancy. Mm-hmm. And then put on the auction block, and then sold to the highest bidder. And then you had to go work for that highest bidder until you had worked off the fine so it really was slavery by another name.
You also write that blacks viewed reading and writing as a contradiction to oppression, obviously, but education hard to come by, and President Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, didn't help matters. What was his view on that?
Oh, Andrew Johnson, I've got to say, has to be one of the worst presidents ever.
Well, C-SPAN just did a ranking, and he always comes out right at the bottom or very close to it. Yeah.
And so Johnson basically believed that, you know, the job was to make sure that the Union was back together again. That had been done. And so he was fine with the re-enslavement of African Americans. He was also fine with the way that slavery had banned education for African Americans prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. So he couldn't see any reason why the Freedmen's Bureau, which had been created coming out of the Civil War, why the Freedmen's Bureau would have to build schools. He's like, why would we do that? We don't do that for our own. But African Americans knew that there was freedom, there was power in education. And even before the Freedmen's Bureau got there to the South, had already built by their own labor 500 schools and to make sure that their children could get educated. Because one of the things that I talk about is that one of the narratives that we have in this society is basically that blacks don't like education. That, they don't want to go to school, But here you're seeing this drive for education. And it is a drive that goes not just from the middle after slavery, but it goes all the way through. I mean, all the way through to today, as you're seeing parents in these town halls or in these school board meetings talking about their children's schools. But we need that narrative in order to justify not, in fact, investing in quality education.
So President Andrew Johnson, a prime example of the white rage you're writing about.
Absolutely.
In this book. Case in point.
Yeah. Absolutely.
In 1870, the 15th Amendment was ratified to give black men the right to vote, but then very quickly moves were made to keep them from the ballot box. What were some of the legal strategies used there? Again, one more example of this pushback.
This pushback, you saw, for instance, the rise of the grandfather clause, which said that if your grandfather voted in the 1860 election, you too could vote. Now, it doesn't say black people can't vote. This is one of the things that's very clever about white rage. It usually isn't that blatant. But who could not vote in the 1860 election? Black people. Because we had slavery. And so we had the grandfather clause. And the poll tax was one of the most insidious. The poll tax said you had to pay a tax in order to vote. Right. But then you had these really arcane rules so that if the election was on a year divisible by four, but not by seven, then you had to pay the tax on the fourth day of the fifth month if that day and month were divisible by three, but not by eight. And then you had to pay it down by the courthouse between 12 and 12:05.
Wow.
And,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, those kinds of arcane rules.
That's breathtaking.
Yes.
Breathtaking.
And the tax was cumulative. So if it took you 20 years to figure out how to pay this tax, you had to pay 20 years of back taxes in order to be able to vote. I worked when I taught at the University of Missouri for 13 years. I worked with a man who had helped his grandfather figure out how to pay his poll tax.
Wow.
Yeah, this stuff is living memory.
This resistance to the black vote was attacked in the middle of the 20th century during the Civil Rights Movement. How successful were strategies like getting Southern African Americans registered to vote?
Oh, it was so difficult. And part of that difficulty in getting, so we have a place like, let's take Alabama. And, remember the movie Selma?
Sure.
Yes. And so in Alabama, in the black belt counties, in some of those counties, you had 0% of African Americans registered to vote. In those same counties, you would have over 100% of whites registered to vote.
You say over 100%, you mean what?
117% of whites in Lowndes County were registered to vote.
How can that be?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah. Your host is catching up with you here. Yeah. Okay.
Right. I mean, so you had a combination of terror, a poll tax, law enforcement, bearing down, closing the courthouse, the strive to vote was strong, and the pushback, legal pushback, was intense.
Yeah. Carol Anderson is my guest. Her new book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It's about this notion that progress by blacks has been met with resistance fueled by white rage. I should point out that she'll be speaking this evening on this very topic, 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza. More information, kclibrary.org. Now, I've got to ask, as you're sitting here, Carol, what do you make of state officials like Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach and his moves to impose strict voter ID laws today?
It is absolutely insidious, and it is so wrong. And so let me walk through that, because I don't want to just talk in these kinds of moral terms.
Mm-hmm.
What the narrative is that there's massive voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to have these elements to keep democracy safe, to protect the integrity of the ballot box.
That's right.
White rage always cloaks its dirt in the language of democracy. So we need to be cognizant of that. Truth. A law professor out of California found from 2000 to 2014, there were 31 cases of voter fraud out of 1 billion votes. 31 cases out of 1 billion. So we don't have massive voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
When Texas was trying to talk about rampant voter fraud and the judge asked the attorney general, okay, show me the cases, he could only point to 2. Again, out of millions of votes. So the whole thing about voter fraud is predicated on a lie. The next thing is cross-check, the thing that Kris Kobach has been pushing that ostensibly stops voter fraud by being able to catch somebody registered to vote, say, in Kansas and also registered to vote in Virginia.
Yeah.
Well, what it does is it's a flawed database. And so it ends up looking...
We've talked about that here just in the last couple of weeks.
Yes,
yeah.
It is so flawed that what it ends up doing is then looking for these names like Garcia, but not matching with the first name and the middle name and the last four of the social
Common names, and you see duplicates, and it may not mean a darn thing.
Right. And you get this massive purging of voter rolls based on a flawed database, and that purging is targeted primarily, who it catches primarily are African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You're not crazy about Kris Kobach.
Not at all.
In the early 1900s, Southern blacks saw opportunities for better employment and wages in the North, and this great migration began that we've known about. Once again, Southern employers faced losing cheap labor. How did they react?
Oh, horribly.
Mm-hmm.
So you had things like passing vagrancy laws. Again, the vagrancy law. So African Americans would be at the train station with the tickets in their hands, and the police would do a roundup and charge African Americans at the train station with being vagrant, and then basically throw them in jail until the trains had left.
Because they were leaving their employers.
Because they were leaving their employers. In some cases, because blacks were leaving in droves, you know, it starts off with a trickle, and then it's just this massive rush. Officials in Mississippi stopping the trains. Actually stopping the trains. You had some locales banning, regardless of the First Amendment, banning the sale of the Chicago Defender, because that black newspaper was saying, y'all need to come north. Come north. We have jobs up north. We have houses up north. And you're not going to get lynched. And they saw the white Southerners saw the Chicago Defender as being like this outside agitator, and said, we've got to shut it down. And my mother tells the story of my grandfather. The Chicago Defender became a badge of honor in the black community. And she said my grandfather would take that Defender, fold it under his arm, get his little swag, walk on going, yeah, I got my fender.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
It meant something to him.
Yes.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about education. Plessy versus Ferguson establishes this separate but equal form of segregation, which hit education especially hard. But then, as you mentioned, Brown versus Board of Education, Topeka, supplants Plessy, so whites divide what came to be called the Southern Manifesto. What was the plan there?
And that plan there was to use every tool at their disposal.
To stall, to defy everything else.
To stall, defy. And because if you keep running this thing back through the courts over and over and over and over again, the hope was, one, that African Americans would get tired, two, that the federal judiciary would get worn out, and that you could wait for another regime to come in that would be more to your liking in terms of this. And I mean, so stall and defy, stall and defy, stall and defy.
I want to just push ahead. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, you think big progress. The Voting Rights Act the following year, major advances. What improvements did African Americans begin to see as a result of those wins and the legal battles that came with them?
Seismic. You saw a lessening of the gap between white and black income. You saw educational attainment really begin to take off, where African Americans went from having 4% within a decade, having 4% holding bachelor's degrees, to now 6% of the black community holding bachelor's degrees. I mean, it was this, it was like being in an oasis, this chance to finally, and boom, they hit it big. And then the Reagan era.
And briefly, what happened there?
And there you saw the massive undermining of the kinds of support structures, from student financial aid for colleges. So in reworking those rules to move from grants to loans, you had a drop of 15,000 fewer African Americans in college in the 1980s than had been in the 1970s. You also saw undermining of support for public transportation, so the ability of people who don't own cars to be able to get to their jobs.
And so, Carol, the takeaway from all this is what?
The takeaway is that all of this has hurt the strength of the United States. And so what this white rage that is targeted at African Americans has massive collateral damage as well. And that we have got to do better about the way that we see our people, our citizens, our nation as a whole. When we push back and envision what a truly strong, inclusive, vibrant nation looks like, I want to say, so think about it. We have wasted $1 trillion on the war on drugs. Imagine what that kind of investment would have looked like in education. Imagine what that would have looked like. Like, we've been talking about Medicare expansion. Imagine what that would have looked like in terms of helping the wellness of all of our citizens in our nation. Because we know when we have a healthy population, then things really begin to move in a certain way. And I think about it in terms of Lee Atwater, who was Reagan's chief strategist. And Lee Atwater said, well, you know, in 1954, you could use the N-word. By 68, you can't. It hurts you. Backfires. So you start talking about all of these things in economic terms, like cutting taxes or forced busing. But the whole point is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. Now, when I hear that, not only is it malevolent, but what you hear is not that blacks, just blacks get hurt, but that whites are going to get hurt too. Whites are part of the collateral damage of the Southern strategy, of this strategy of masking things in colorblind language, but having a very strong racial basis, racist basis for the policy.
Carol Anderson's new book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Again, she speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the plaza. Really enjoyed having you, Carol.
Oh,
thanks so much.
Steve.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to the budget director of the state of Kansas. His name is Sean Sullivan. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we got tips for dealing with the young picky eaters in your household. Hear our conversation with a dietitian and a pediatrician. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow is Friday. We get the indie, foreign, and documentary film critics in here to review what's showing in area theaters, and they'll tell us about some of the short films that made the Oscar shortlist this year. Well, last week, former budget director of Kansas, Dwayne Gosen, raised serious concerns about the shape of the state budget. He said the budget remains hundreds of millions of dollars out of balance. In fact, the figure is as high as $1 billion over the next 2 years in a state with a general fund budget of $6 billion. He's not the only voice sounding concerns. S&P, the credit ratings company, issued a lowered credit outlook for Kansas a few days ago, citing weak economic trends and structural budget pressures. The proposed budget does not adequately provide solutions to Kansas's ongoing structural deficits. That's what S&P said in its report. Joining me now to offer the Brownback administration's view of the budget is current budget director. His name is Sean Sullivan. And Sean, nice to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you, Steve.
If I had to rank a tough job in Missouri or Kansas these days, Sean, yours might rank up there pretty high. Am I right about that?
Yeah, certainly we're in difficult times here in Kansas, but we'll say that it's not a situation that's uncommon around the country. It's probably 25 or 30 states that may not be as dire, drastic circumstances in Kansas with our shortfall, but there are 25, 30 states that have shortfalls, even the states around us, particularly here in the Plains, Midwest. Some even have larger shortfalls than we do, particularly related to the economy. So, but definitely difficult circumstances, both for the administration and also for legislators.
Well, given that, then, how concerned should Kansans be about these billion-dollar deficits that we keep reading about?
Well, I think they should be concerned. I think the question is, how do we deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it going to be taxes? Is it going to be cuts? Is it going to be both? Is it going to be a mixture of those two plus one-time fixes? I think everyone has demonstrated or talked about the need to be on more structural sound footing, to have greater reserves and what we call ending balances than what we've had the last couple years, greater margins, so we can withstand the volatility. So hopefully we're headed that way. The big question is how to get there. No matter what happens, I don't see our economy really changing all that much in the next year or two, particularly around agriculture and our energy sectors that we rely so heavily on here in Kansas. So I think we're not going to be out of the woods for some time, no matter what happens this session.
My guest is Kansas Budget Director Sean Sullivan. You know, Sean, as we're talking about remedies here and solutions that you just alluded to, let me just ask, will the governor sign any bill that raises taxes? Is that a possibility?
He will. He proposed more of a consumption tax with his budget in January, so he'll definitely sign one. The question at this point is, what version, what mm-hmm. would that look like? So obviously the Senate and the House here in Kansas and Topeka went through a very public discussion and battle over the last week with income tax increase, retro income tax increase that passed both sides. That was vetoed yesterday morning,
right,
and then failed to override that veto in the Senate yesterday afternoon. The governor has asked me to work with Senate and House leadership and others over the next couple of days to try to develop a number of alternatives. So that's really what I'm starting to work on today.
Yeah, as we sit here today, we're toward the end of February, and I guess the good news is the state and the legislature is dealing with this issue pretty early in the session. We're not waiting till the last minute, as you so often see here. But given the tricky nature of trying to navigate a legislature and a governor here on what folks will accept, how confident are you that some kind of an accord can be reached this session?
As you said, I think it's better that we're dealing with this in February. On the flip side, I would rather see that we deal with both the budget and taxes at the same time, and I think we got the cart in front of the horse this last week, and we're only dealing with the tax side of the equation. So we voted to raise taxes significantly without knowing what the final budget was going to look like for the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least on the House side, we turn around and say, well, we need these tax increases of revenue to deal with the spending levels. But then, you know, the same day they go and vote to expand Medicaid, which would cost about $100 million more over the next couple of years. So I think we need to deal with this all together, and hopefully we're headed that direction. But in the same breath, I will say, it would rather have these conversations sooner in the session rather
right.
than in June, July, or August.
So it sounds like you're saying you want to deal, you and the governor would like to deal with the budget and get that set and what the spending needs are going to be before you launch into a conversation about tax, the potential for tax increases.
Well, I think you have to do them both at the same time, approximate same time frame. Try to deal with both sides of the ledger. There are some that will vote for cuts. There are some that won't, and it's a matter of trying to find what the mix is for the number of votes that we need. But if we're only dealing with taxes, then we don't know what the level of revenue is going to be needed to mm-hmm. deal with the budget that's passed. If you're only dealing with the budget and not taxes, you don't know what revenue is going to be coming in to know what your budgetary needs are. So
right.
I think they need to come in kind of in a parallel type course, and at the end of the day, just know they're both there and work both of them to try to get the number of votes that are needed.
You know, the governor has proposed a plan that includes increases in alcohol and tobacco taxes, the so-called sin taxes. He's talked about
right.
liquidating a long-term investment fund and selling off the state's future proceeds from a settlement with tobacco companies to get cash now. I'm wondering, even though yesterday this override of the veto fell short in the Senate by just a couple votes, you had significant majorities voting against Governor Brownback. Does that mean that the governor's overall budget proposal is dead on arrival, Sean, or how do you look at it?
I think you have to segregate it out to different parts of the proposal. If you look at this year, so we are in what we call fiscal year 2017, which ends June 30th of this year. I think at the end of the day, most of his budget proposal for this year will end up being adopted. It's one that liquidates a long-term investment loan in order to prevent significant cuts to K-12 this year. I think for the next 2 years, that's really where the big question is for me, how much, if any, of his proposal will be adopted. And that's where I think let's do budget and taxes together instead of doing taxes now and then not mm-hmm. doing the budget until April or May. So, but obviously this is a much different makeup of the legislature than what we've had the last 4 years
mm-hmm.
and very different nature of the political philosophy. So that's something that we have to deal with as we move forward.
I wanted to ask you also point blank if the governor will sign a bill that eliminates the LLC exemption. That's the exemption that allows more than 330,000 business owners to pay zero state tax on their incomes. Will he sign a bill that eliminates that exemption?
Without knowing what else is in the rest okay. of that package, that's a hard question to answer. He did say in his veto press conference yesterday for the tax bill he vetoed that he is willing to compromise on that small business exemption. A number of states have looked at putting caps in place or thresholds. So what that would look like is the first $100,000, $150,000 of the income for a small business would be exempt, and then anything over that would be taxed at the prevailing rate. But with that said, I mean, we'll see where the whole thing goes and whether that part of it can be negotiated or not. So he's open to compromise as far as though what he will or won't sign. It kind of depends, I think, on what's in the overall package.
The governor has blamed downturns in the state economy for a lot of these budget problems. He cited a depressed farm economy and the aviation sector for the shortfalls. Do you agree with that, Sean? Is that the cause of this?
Well, I think there are a couple of causes, but certainly the economic situation is a large part of it. When you look at just the tax receipts that we have coming in, so as you said earlier, we have about $6 billion in expenditures, $6 billion in tax collections coming into our general fund. you go back 25 years, we grow by $200 to $250 million a year in tax revenue, which is about 3.5% to 4%.
Mm-hmm.
That is over the last 25 years, which certainly there's been good and bad times, including that time period. When you look at the last 3 years, we've only grown by 0.3%, which is 12% less growth than what we normally get. So if we would have grown like we normally had, we'd have $800 to $900 million more this year than what we actually have. And I think most of that is related to tax cuts were baked into the cake. It already happened. So I think most of that is related to agriculture and energy. And that's something that I was pretty skeptical about last year as we were looking at that. And the reason for that was say to myself, well, you know, how much is agriculture really affecting the tax collections that we see? Because they combines, tractors are exempt for what they buy. But when you look at our sales tax trends, you look at that on a county-by-county basis for our state, they aren't buying, because of the lack of income for agriculture and farmers and ranchers, they aren't buying large vehicles, they aren't buying other disposable income, and that has somewhere between $150 to $200 million annual effect just on our sales tax alone, let alone the other tax categories. So I do think it is a large impact on what we are collecting.
I want to get replay a comment that Dwayne Gosin, again, the former Kansas budget director, said about this argument of what's the blame for the revenue shortfalls here. This is what Dwayne Gosin said when he visited our studios last week, and this is the second cut, Linda.
The part of the Kansas economy that depends on oil and gas prices and ag prices has been certainly pressed in the last year or so, but the problems with the Kansas budget originated far before that. The income loss to the state budget occurred immediately after the tax cuts went into effect. Yes, the ag prices and oil prices have made things a little bit worse, but if the Kansas budget were set up in such a way for a solid financial position, Kansas would be able to weather those ups and downs of the economy and be okay. We're not in a recession now. We've got some slumps in a few areas, but Kansas should have a financial system in place that allows the state to weather that kind of up and down that's normal in the cycle.
Sean, react to that if you would.
Well, it's kind of typical Dwayne Gosin. He likes to throw out certain talking points without providing context. So the tax cuts had already happened by 2014. That revenue had already decreased, as he mentioned. We had a structurally balanced budget 2 years ago when legislators were here, when they passed it for this year. And then that's when we really started seeing the significant decrease in agricultural commodity prices. So we've had virtually no growth in our tax collections over the last 3 years. That hasn't had anything to do with the tax cuts, and it has had to do with the economy. I mean, there also is a spending side of the ledger here. Dwayne has pointed out accurately that there have been a number of cuts the last number of years. We've had a hard time with particularly schools and growth in Medicaid and schools. But our tax receipts at this point and the lack of growth in tax receipts has been the primary issue that we've had with the budget. But that said, it is something that we have to deal with now and to fix.
I'm just wondering, as you go about dealing with your job day in and day out, Sean, this notion that the news always seems to be bad when it comes to the budget. I'm wondering if you wish you could be budget director in more flush times.
There are times in our state's history where those tax collections were coming in at 8-9%.
Yes.
And yes, it's certainly much easier to give money out as opposed to take it away. But it is a situation we're in.
Sean Sullivan, budget director for the state of Kansas, thanks very much for giving us a few minutes and bringing us up to speed here. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you all. Have a great day.
You too. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, look who's here, Brian McTavish, who comes in each week to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekends. And I like that. And what am I liking? I that's good.
You like that.
I do like that.
I like that. That's Valerie June.
Wow.
Could be. We got a lot of shows to talk about. Could be the show of the weekend.
Wow.
That's why it's leading off. 8:30 Saturday night, Knucklehead Saloon. We're looking at folk, soul, blues, gospel, Appalachian, bluegrass, pop rock, and
all wrapped up in one nice package.
Actually, you say wrapped up. She's got her hair, it's a trademark in the making, wrapped up into this crazy Medusa-ish kind of piled high hairdo on the top of her head there.
Yeah.
Her artistic choice, that's her persona, I guess, and it's quite eye-catching. But we're talking music, right? So
yes.
Once again, try to maybe wander over to Knucklehead Saloon Saturday night and get the whole package.
I've been known to do that from time to time.
Well, you actually are the one to go do that.
Yeah.
Now, she released two independent albums. One was the first was The Way of the Weeping Willow. And the other was The Mountain of Rose Quartz. And those were well-received, got a lot of nice airplay in Europe. But it was really 2013's Pushing Against the Stone. That was her breakthrough, kind of an autobiographical title, Pushing Against the Stone, because she was trying for years to make it in Memphis, Tennessee. That's where she's from, right? You might have seen her some years ago on the MTV Online series $5 Cover, which focused on Memphis musicians trying to make a go of their craft, right? Well, she is making more than a go of it, and you can be part of that Saturday at Knucklehead.
8:30 Saturday at Knuckles, Valerie June.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty good.
Oh, absolutely.
Chased Lady Luck till we finally struck Bonanza. With a gun and a rope and a hat full of hope, we planted our family tree. We got a hold of a pot full of gold, Bonanza. With a horse and a saddle.
Well, we're talking Western something going on here.
Okay, I try to bring a little something different every week.
And you do such a great job.
And I dare say, thank you, my friend, I dare say you have never treated the ears of listeners to the theme of Bonanza.
I know.
Let alone the hardly ever heard version in which Pa Cartwright himself, Lorne Greene, is singing these crazy lyrics to that wonderful 1960s Western TV show. And before we move on to the 2017 Western Farm Show, which is all day Friday and Saturday at the American Royal Complex, you can go down to the West Bottoms and pretend you're a rancher or a farmer. But I want to talk a little bit about Bonanza because that's what I do. I take things where I please. Who were the original character names on Bonanza? I gave you one. Ben Cartwright. That was Pa.
And Joe.
Little Joe.
Little Joe.
I'll give you that one. Okay, give me one more. You got one.
Pa.
Oh, my goodness.
Pa.
Yes, you're getting there.
Adam.
You're like lassoing a fleeing steer with
it's
this.
It's all coming to me
it's
magically.
It's Ben. It's Adam. It's Hoss. And it's Little Joe. But did you know when Adam, who was actually actor Purnell Roberts, left in the late 60s, who was he replaced by? Forget the actor's name. I can't remember that one either. But what was the guy's name? Who became the extra?
I don't know these things.
This was very brave to do in late 60s TV. His name was Candy. They called a roughneck cowboy Candy. You remember that?
Yeah, I do.
And then they canceled the show. But anyway, yes.
And the point of that
Well, the point of it is I go crazy. But ostensibly, we're concerned with the 2017 Western Farm Show. And even if you're not remotely interested in Green Acres.
What did Candy have to do with this?
Candy? Well, they'll have Candy at the Western Farm Show. But I was giving you all of the unnecessary details about the Bonanza theme and the show that it came from. Anyway, go see the Western Farm Show if you're into cattle, or if you're into farming, or if you're just into cooking shows and
let's
and
just
fun.
End this while we can.
Wrote American Royal Complex. Blah, 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 it's over.
Be sure to see Brian Six completely different things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
This house has sure been good to me. White lines as far as you can see. There's a girl from down around Poteet wants to meet me down on Frio Street.
That sounds pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah. Now, back to reality. This is an actual bona fide country star. It's commercial country, y'all. It's the Randy Rogers Band.
Never heard of Randy Rogers.
Well, He's
a star, you're saying. I'll take your word for it.
No, he's a successful guy because he's the real accessible country music deal. No gimmicks. His hero is fellow Texan George Strait, who, as you might recall, you know George Strait.
Yes.
George Strait played it straight, except for the big cowboy hat, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, and I will say George Strait was kind of a conventional hunk in the 90s, was he not?
I guess.
Okay, not so much, if I can go there, not so much Randy Rogers. He's a little beefier than your average country heartthrob, but his voice is outstanding. He has lots of charisma. He knows how to corral the masses, touch hearts, get feet tapping, and this is one of his more recent ditties called San Antone.
8 p.m. Friday at the Uptown.
Absolutely.
What is that?
Well, that kind of sounds
like... What is that?
Oh, stop it, Dad.
Yeah.
Come on. Come on.
What is that?
Turn that down.
Yes.
Okay, that sounds an awful lot like AC/DC, right?
Yeah.
Heavy metal.
Does it?
Yes.
I don't know what it sounds like. Yeah.
I feel like it's 1973, and I'm in the upstairs bedroom, and some old man is yelling at me. Okay, it's Hairball.
That'd be right.
It's Hairball. You'll like this. Maybe we can cough up some fun this weekend, okay? And go see Hairball, which is this heavyweight cover band that tackles the most famous arena rockers of all time, like AC/DC, like Queen, Aerosmith, Motley Crue, etc. And when and where? It's Friday night, 8:30, Voodoo Lounge, Harrah's Casino.
I think we'll skip it.
Not me. Not me.
What do we have here?
Well, you know, they say, and the Tremolos in 1967 sang that silence was golden, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
and
remember
the point,
that?
There's a point here.
Well, there's always a point. I'll eventually get to it, perhaps. It's a stage play called No Talking. It's about boys versus girls in a no-talking contest.
Sounds kind of funny.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
It's for ages 8 and up. That includes you and me. And it's boys versus girls in the 5th grade. So the question is this. Who can keep quiet the longest? Who can keep... Boys or girls? Who can keep their mouth shut?
No, the girls would lose.
Well, there you have it. I guess we know the answer to that.
And if it was Steve versus Danny Alexander, our producer... Danny would lose.
She's lost already.
Yeah,
on the other side of the glass, she's losing as we speak. Here, you and me, real quiet now for 2 seconds.
No,
go.
Stop it.
See, we can do it.
Yeah.
Coterie Theater, Crown Center, shows Friday night, matinee Saturday and Sunday. No talking. You'll talk about no talking, I promise. Enjoy the show for kids and families.
That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Okay, man.
Tomorrow on the show, the Indie Foreign and Documentary Film Critics are back to review the latest silver screen offerings. They'll give us a rundown of some of this year's Oscar-nominated short films. I love short films. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.